Before the internet, before science, before written language even, there was belief in the afterlife. Ideas about the hereafter are so old they predate Homo sapiens. Archaeologists say that Neanderthals buried food and flowers with their dead treasures to take with them into the great unknown. Our conceptions of the afterlife have varied greatly through the ages. The Egyptians mummified the body in preparation for life after death. The ancient Greeks imagined the lackluster netherworld ruled by the god Hades. Christians believe in heaven, an eternal paradise for the faithful, and some believe in a hell of eternal damnation. Religious scholar Alan Siegel has written a new book that traces the history of the afterlife in Western religion. It's called Life After Death, and it focuses on the origins and evolutions of our ideas about what happens to us when we die, and what our notions of the great beyond say about us here on Earth. Where do you get your ideas about the afterlife? If you believe in one, what does it look like to you? And does it affect the way you live your life here on Earth? Have your ideas about the afterlife changed over time? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Alan Siegel joins us from NPR's Bureau in New York City. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
Much of the West has become rather secular. You mentioned in your book, obviously, the United States is a peculiar exception, or an exception, not peculiar. But why do you think it differs from the rest of the Western world?
Well, the United States is different in that Americans like to answer yes to the question, do you believe in God or do you believe in the afterlife? And in fact, in some studies, 92 or 93% of us say yes to the question, do you believe in God, and even more to the afterlife. So there are lots of people who don't believe in God and yet feel that we deserve one. And that makes us different from Europeans and even considerably different from our neighbors, the Canadians, just north of us. So we are a very affirming, religiously affirming society. And I think that one reason why that's true is because of our First Amendment. We have a First Amendment that essentially guarantees a free market in religion, and it makes all religions work to get an audience. So unlike most other countries of the West that have a state-sponsored religion, we demand that all our religions fight and compete with each other for our attention. So I think we have a very vibrant religious life.
You write that Americans' notions of the afterlife say a lot about who we are as people. What sorts of things are you talking about?
Well, it turns out that questions about our religious values are as important to finding out who we are as zip codes, as our level of education, as our political interests. And the reason for that appears to be that we have very different views of the afterlife depending on what kind of religious community we live in. The majority of Americans believe that we all are all entitled to an afterlife, a pleasant one, but a rather sizable and vocal minority of us, namely the evangelical and fundamentalist community, think of it more in traditional terms of resurrection of the body, and of course believe very strongly in hell, while the most of us seem to have let that drop out of American consciousness. That wouldn't have been true a century ago.
You're giving us a lot to chew on, but I want to get back to some of these things.
Sure.
You said earlier, more Americans believe in an afterlife than say they believe in God. What
right.
does that tell us about us?
Well, it means that there are a number of Americans who believe that we deserve an afterlife even if we don't believe in God. And so the notion that life will go on in a relatively pleasant way after we die is a very attractive one to Americans. And many of us describe it as being more or less like an ideal form of our life here on Earth. Americans want there to be education, adult education. They want to have laughter. They want to see friends in the afterlife. They want to develop. It sounds very much like an adult education program.
Are we simply scared of dying, or is there more going on here?
Well, I think everyone is scared of dying to an extent. But the interesting thing is that death anxiety is lower among people who have significant religious beliefs. So if we look at the evangelical and fundamentalist part of our population, we see that they have, in fact, lower anxieties about death, and as do the aged. The young people who like to say that they don't believe in afterlife at all actually have higher death anxiety than older people.
People who we like to think of, we say they think of themselves as immortal. You say that doesn't actually work out.
Well, very few of us have made it to immortality without dying, let's put it that way.
I wanted to get back to also something you said about fundamentalists and their belief in resurrection. And there's throughout your book, there are really two schools of thought argue back and forth, and that's the resurrection of the body school of thought, and then there's the immortal soul school of thought. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I wanted to understand what was at stake throughout history by believing in one kind of afterlife rather than another. Why would some people want immortality of the soul or resurrection of the body? So I began with the modern United States, so I could see if there was any significant sociological differences or political differences, and I found that there are enormous ones. Most Americans believe that we will have some kind of immortality of the soul. In other words, we'll leave the body behind in some way, and our personality or our consciousness will go on to a higher stage of belief. The big exception to that are, again, the evangelicals and fundamentalists, who believe that we will have bodily resurrection. They know what that means from the New Testament, and they know that we will be put back into our bodies and will live on the earth. And although other Americans think that we'll call it resurrection, they generally don't describe it as bodily resurrection. So I know that there is a very important distinction between afterlives in the United States. Evangelicals believe in resurrection and bodily resurrection and know what it means. The vast majority of Americans believe in immortality of the soul, even if they call it resurrection. And so I wanted to take that perception back to the ancient world and look and see what it might have meant in the ancient world.
And you do take it back. You go back, as we mentioned, to the Neanderthals. But you begin a lot of your book with the Egyptians, who had their own. Was it resurrection?
It isn't resurrection in the sense that we mean it. But the Egyptians are, of course, as we know, a culture obsessed by the afterlife. Certainly by what they left behind, these huge tombs and pyramids and all of the artistic productions that went into making them the great tourist attractions that they are today. But the Egyptians seemed to believe at first that the pharaoh was immortal, and he was immortal because he was a kind of a god. He represented Horus, the falcon god, while he was alive. And afterwards, he went to his father Osiris and became one with him. It seemed to me that he didn't really have to do anything to deserve that. He was, in some way, a symbol of the fertility of the Nile, of the great bounty that the Nile gave the Egyptian people. And in immortalizing him, they were saying that this wonderful good fortune of the Nile was going on forever. But the strange thing is that his body was mummified on earth, let's say in a pyramid or a tomb, and he was free to travel around in the heavens. So it wasn't a real immortality. It wasn't a real resurrection at all. They didn't expect the body to get up and walk away. Mm-hmm. They expected that one of his souls, and the Egyptians had several kinds of souls, would be free to walk around during the day, and that was why they wrote all these spells.
You also write that the Egyptians over time, and as we all know, the Egyptians had plenty of time, that this idea of who got to be immortal slowly expanded.
Well, that's right. Something as important as immortality couldn't be the prerequisite only of the pharaoh. Soon his courtiers began to be part of it, and of course, as they were functional and were able to serve the state, they began to have the ability to make tombs and to decorate their tombs with spells that guided them to immortality. And so we find the notion of immortality spreading out among the upper classes, and eventually it gets to the middle classes. And of course, what's interesting about the middle classes is that they need to prove that they're worthy of the afterlife. So we see in the later Egyptian documents, the New Kingdom documents, the famous Egyptian Book of the Dead, in which ordinary people show up at a courtroom scene and have to prove that their souls are lighter than a feather. And if they don't do that, then they have to die a second time, at this time forever. If they prove that their souls, or actually their hearts, are lighter than a feather, then they get pretty much the same kind of reward that the pharaohs get.
That courtroom scene has been replayed many times in movies and television, more modern or stranger settings, or more modern, I guess, is the word, settings. Here's an email we got from Andy Pearson in Jacksonville, Florida. The best concept of the afterlife I ever saw was an episode of Night Gallery in which John Astin played a hippie who wrecked his hot rod and went to hell. The jukebox played only Lawrence Welk, and soon an old couple appeared and began showing their thousands of vacation slides as Astin writhed on the floor screaming, "No!" The devil appeared and explained to Astin that for the old couple, this was heaven.
Right. Well, of course, heaven and hell are opposites of each other. And so whatever you think is wonderful about heaven, then hell is the negation of that. And we always use hell, reserve it for not only for sinners, but also for our enemies.
We want to hear from listeners, of course, and from emailers. Where do your ideas of the afterlife come from? What do they look like? Where do you get your images from? How do they influence your life? Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's bring in Jerry, who's with us from Fort Myers.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
Now, I was originally raised Catholic. I went to Catholic school for the first 5 years of my life, and after thousands of dollars of therapy and years in recovery, I can almost sleep through the night now. But at this point, my spirituality is 12-step in nature, and what I believe at this point is that you go back. Once you die, you go back. And then you get told whether you did it right or not. And if you didn't do it right, they send you back. And they keep sending you back until you get it right. And then once you get it right, you get to stay.
So this is a reincarnation until you have proven yourself.
That's it.
Uh-huh. Alan Siegel, where does this idea of reincarnation, not necessarily Jerry's particular idea, come from?
Well, part of it comes from the notion of the immortality of the soul, which is a Greek notion. And when Plato outlined it, in his dialogues through his teacher Socrates, one of the things he said about it is that we keep on coming back to earth until we finally figure out, you know, how to be a good person and how to be free of the many temptations that life gives us. And so this is really a form of immortality of the soul. In fact, several of the church fathers felt that reincarnation was the only way for human beings to be treated truly mercifully by God. Each of these church fathers was looked askance by the Orthodox Church eventually. The most famous one was Origen of Alexandria, who believed exactly what Jerry has said to us, that you keep on coming back until you perfect yourself, because he couldn't believe that God would ever curse anyone forever.
Jerry, did you get your idea from reading Plato?
No, I got my idea from what little I know about Buddhist philosophy. But there's an old rumor that I've been hearing for years that there used to be books in the Bible that talked about reincarnation, but when they had the meeting at Nicaea to edit out the Bible, that they got stuck on the wayside. Is there any truth in that?
We're going to have to bring that up after we come back from the break, Jerry, because it's not going to be answerable in the next 23 seconds we have left in this segment. But thanks very much for the phone call.
Thanks a lot.
And we're speaking with Alan F. Siegel, professor of religion at Barnard College at Columbia University in New York, the author most recently of Life After Death, A History of the Afterlife in Western Religion. We'll be having more after a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how we conceive the afterlife, how our beliefs about what happens after death may define our time here on Earth, and how the notion of an afterlife has changed across religions and over time. Our guest is Alan Siegel. His most recent book, Life After Death, A History of the Afterlife in Western Religion. He's also a professor of religion and Jewish studies at Barnard College and Columbia University. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And I wanted to give you a chance to address Jerry's question that we had before the break on parts about reincarnation edited out of the Bible. I also wanted to put in this email we got from Megan Brown in Grand Forks, North Dakota. I'm a Unitarian who believes in an afterlife of reincarnation, and here's why. Every once in a while, one will meet someone who has what I like to call an old soul, someone wise beyond their years, as if they've had more life experience than the people around them. I'm curious as to what your guest thinks about the concept of old souls versus younger souls.
Well, to get to Jerry's question first, there's no evidence that the Hebrew Bible contained books that were more friendly to reincarnation, but there are in Christian mysticism and in Jewish mysticism especially books that are revered as if they are parts of the Bible, parts of the Kabbalah, the Zohar, in which reincarnation is certainly a significant issue, and the people, the mystics who believe in them, think of them as just as old as the Bible. That's the first part. And secondly, if you're talking about reincarnation, then it's a simple matter to think of all souls as old souls because we recycle. And that is very much a Greek philosophical notion. And it enters into Hebrew thought in the period just before Jesus. But one of the things that the Jews do to it is that they cut out the multiple lives. They pretty much think that we have one life to live. So that's a notion that comes to us from Greece, but it doesn't make it through the mill of rabbinic Judaism or other kinds of Judaism, or on the whole, not into Christianity.
Hmm. Here's Dwayne. Dwayne's on the line with us from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hello, Alan.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in my 50s now, okay, and I've been—I've never really thought about life after death, except for when my mom talked about it. And you know, after I started having these little anxiety problems, like you know, they'd say, "Oh, well, you're going to be resurrected in the new life and come to this church because this church is going to do it for you and nobody else will, whatever." And I started thinking about it. So, well, isn't it kind of like having your cake and eating it too? You know, and I mean, I have a resentment for death. Okay, I don't particularly want to die, you know, but I can see where, you know, the world, you know, keeps changing. But it, to me, it's kind of like a greed thing. I don't know if anybody ever sees it like that other than me. I mean, a lot of people tell me I think really different. But and I've checked out Buddhism, and my mom, like, you know, she was a Baptist, and she pretty much, you know, told me just it's all in the Bible. So I've read the Bible a lot, and I've answered a lot of questions. And then when I found out that Socrates was, you know, was executed for questioning the idea of God, you know, I thought, well, just a minute ago I said, well, you know, if we get resurrected, if our souls come back again, maybe I'm in part Socrates or something, because I started questioning the idea of a God. You know, I just don't understand why a God would make a planet. You know, that's, you know, it's you either live or you die. You know, it's a fight for survival. And you know, if you're not killing, then you're getting killed. And to me, it's not a loving, wonderful God. So I'm saying there must be, if there is a God out there, I'd say that he really doesn't care. You know, it's not a God that any man can conceive of, you know?
Well, I think you're right about reading the Bible. The Hebrew Bible, especially, is very silent about life after death. And this is quite strange, considering that Egypt, which we've already talked about, and Canaan and Mesopotamia had very, very strong views of afterlife. And yet, if you read Psalm 90, you hear that the years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80, yet their span is but toil and trouble, and we are soon gone.
Bring it up in the context of the book of Job as well.
Right, and there really is no afterlife in the book of Job. And the Hebrews were, like you are, very stoic about the fact that you have this life, God has given it to you, and to expect more than that is somehow to be greedy, as you said. But things change in the Hebrew Bible when you get to Daniel. in Daniel chapter 12, verse 3, we have a discussion in a vision of what the end of time is going to look like. And it says that at that time, some of those who sleep in the dust will arise, and some of those who arise will be given eternal punishments, and others will be given eternal bliss. And the bliss works out this way, that those who are wise, or who cause people to be wise, will shine like the stars of heaven. So in some sense, Daniel is preaching or predicting through his vision that some of us will become stars, by which he appears to mean angels.
But, Brian, you know, like in the Bible, one place I read where it said the dead feel nothing, they think nothing, you know, along the lines of basically it's over with.
Well, right. So, the Psalms are difficult to date, and they have very ambiguous notions, but one of them is clearly that live people praise God and the dead feel nothing. So it's a way of asking God to extend your life.
Dwayne, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Email from Frank DeAndrea in Portland, Oregon. Is there evidence of a culture that does not ascribe to an afterlife or reincarnation? If not, why would this belief arise independently around the globe?
Well, pretty much everyone believes in an afterlife as cultures go. Of course, there are always individuals who don't believe what their culture is telling them. There are plenty of Americans right now who don't. But in point of fact, since the Neanderthals until now, we have a choice of many, many cultures' notions of what the afterlife is. And the amazing thing is that they don't cohere very well. Each culture designs what it thinks is important for its afterlife, and they don't necessarily have any relationship to other people's afterlives.
But isn't our image of the afterlife an idea of sort of received wisdom, no matter which religion it is you ascribe to?
Well, for us in the West, it's almost always a combination of immortality of the soul and resurrection of the body. And I should say that Judaism and Islam combine those two notions very easily, but Christianity had a great deal of trouble with immortality of the soul, and I'll tell you why. The Gospels say that Jesus was resurrected from the dead, and his death is saving for all of us. But if you believe in immortality of the soul, the way Socrates and Plato appeared to, you believe that that's a natural property of the soul. And so if it's a natural property of the soul, why would you need Jesus' saving death? So early Christianity was very, very skeptical about immortality of the soul. They rejected it. And it took Christianity centuries to find a way to absorb that notion into Christianity. And indeed, the fact that it did so shows that Christianity was giving up its millenarian and apocalyptic framework, which Jesus originally preached. In other words, to accept immortality of the soul, one had to give up the notion that the end of the world was coming soon. And that's precisely what Christianity did.
Let's get another caller in. Chris is with us from Arcosanti, Arizona.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I've actually changed my question from listening. I have an even better question. I wonder if your guest is familiar with either the writing of Philip K. Dick or Pierre Teilhard, if I'm saying his name right, the noosphere concept.
Oh, Teilhard Chardin.
Right. Yeah, and if you could maybe just
I can cover him on Philip K. Dick.
Okay, well, good.
Philip K. Dick, I was wondering, too, if you could comment on his exegesis, where he had an experience that he related with a past life. His doctors were telling him he was possibly schizophrenic, but he was speaking like Koine Greek, a really old Greek. He said he thought in that Greek, he wrote in that Greek. He's like, you know, pretty crazy, but a well-renowned writer. And he had a lot of these crazy experiences that he could only explain as reincarnation, where he remembered Jerusalem, he remembered Rome. The Greek was a really crazy thing that he remembered to speak, to write, to think in that language that he'd never heard. Just odd things like that. I was wondering if you could comment on any of those things, and on Chardin as well.
He doesn't have to have read Philip K. Dick to comment on that, but go ahead.
Well, people have experiences all the time, revelatory experiences, revelatory dreams, near-death experiences. These are real experiences in which people become convinced that they have lived before or will live again. And that, indeed, is the way in which the notion of resurrection enters Hebrew thought. I mean, if you have a scriptural tradition, as the Hebrews did, that didn't include very much about the afterlife, and we can talk about why the Hebrews excluded it, and you want to add a new notion of the afterlife, it's almost necessary to have a revelation to do this. And people, I think it's a normal part of the human mind that we do have these extraordinary experiences. There's a book called Why God Won't Go Away, and it suggests that we are, in a sense, wired to have these extraordinary experiences in which our religious life is innovated, and we find new ways of expressing what the afterlife is about.
And you write a lot about near-death experiences, not quite what Philip K. Dick was talking about in the example that the caller was talking about, but near-death experiences as, tell us how you think about that. Clearly, the people who have them are very, very convinced.
Well, the funny thing is that Americans' near-death experiences confirm our notion, our relatively optimistic notion that we're all going to heaven. But if you look at near-death experiences over 2,000 years of history, you find that most often in the past they were fearful experiences in which people experienced going to hell. And when they recovered from it, then they changed their lives and became good religious people. It seems to most Americans that we don't need to do that. Most of us think we're living just fine lives, and so we experience heaven when we have these experiences. I don't necessarily feel that there's anything unusual about these experiences. They could be a normal aspect of trauma, and indeed, people who take drugs or who meditate can have the feeling of being outside their body. There are perfectly good physiological and neurological reasons why we have these experiences. There is a street drug called ketamine that is famous for, also known as Special K, which is famous for allowing people to feel that they're out of their body and traveling to heaven. Normally, people who go to the party scene don't necessarily want to feel that way, so they would rather be there dancing than away someplace. But mystics would prefer to have that the other part of the experience, and so it very much depends on what your expectations are.
Our guest is Alan Siegel. His new book is Life After Death, A History of the Afterlife in Western Religion. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a call in. This is Ayman, who joins us from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
Yes, hi.
You're on the air, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. My question to Professor Siegel is, this is a very interesting point in studying how Americans would think of this, but do you think that it's best to think of life after death as everybody having his own idea, or should we be more looking of one common belief as to, because this would essentially govern all our actions, life after death is the ultimate goal of everyone? So this is what I wanted to ask.
Well, I think that both Christianity and Islam provide us with a very strong conception of life after death. Both of them are have strong notions of heaven and hell, and both are proselytizing religions. Judaism, on the other hand, which has not very often been a proselytizing religion, has very weak forms of life after death and very weak forms of heaven and hell. So I think that the notion of al-Jannah and things that are in Islam, as well as the notions of heaven and hell in Christianity, are in those religions because they want to convert people to the body of the faithful and make them live moral lives. I don't know if you would agree or not, but it certainly seems to be true of Islam.
Yeah, that is true. But it's just, it's interesting if everybody has his own idea, but on a because thinking of life after this would be the ultimate goal, you know. I want to do good things because I want to go to heaven. So, we ought to give it a lot of thought, you know, on what is true among amongst all the ideas you said. And
well, I think
that's what I wanted to say.
Different
thank
religions.
You.
Thank you very much for the call, Ayman. Different religions also claim exclusivity over who gets into heaven and who gets into hell. You have to pay attention to our moral codes to reach heaven. And as you said earlier, I think hell was reserved for enemies.
Well, I think that's right. And the traditional forms of the afterlife in, say, Christianity and Islam most often involve resurrection, and bodily resurrection seems to arise at a time period when martyrs were demanded, in other words, when the religion was being persecuted. So people who are presented with martyrdom seem to want their bodies back. Very often these are young people who want to live out their lives as they were asked to. And, of course, the fundamental experience of Christianity, the death and resurrection of Jesus, is a martyrdom, if you think about it for a moment. And his believers believed that he had conquered death and conquered his oppressors by arising from the dead, and that brought in the end of the world. Muslims also have a very strong relationship between resurrection of the body and martyrdom, which, of course, the West has become all too aware of. But ordinary Muslims normally put these two together and live perfectly moral lives. In fact, that's the point of it. Immortality of the soul, on the other hand, is not a young person's notion. Plato and Socrates were old men, and they were wise men, and they were teachers. So immortality of the soul is sort of a professor's afterlife. You leave your body behind. I mean, if you saw mine from where you sit, you would realize that there's no way I'm getting this body back. What you want to do is to preserve your consciousness. If you have been alive all these years and asking all these important philosophical questions and gaining wisdom, what immortality of the soul tells you is that your mind, your consciousness, your wisdom will outlive you. And so in terms of social class, immortality of the soul becomes very popular among intellectual elites, whereas resurrection of the body becomes important among young people, freedom fighters, millenarians, apocalypticists, people who are asked to give up their lives.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our discussion with Alan Siegel about his book, Life After Death, A History of the Afterlife in Western Religion. And we'll talk about conceptions of life after death, martyrdom, and the great beyond. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about the afterlife, how it's been imagined over time, and about modern-day conceptions. Our guest is Alan Siegel, the author of Life After Death, A History of the Afterlife in Western Religion, also professor of religion and Jewish studies at Barnard College at Columbia University. He's joining us from NPR's Bureau in New York City. And let's get back to the callers. Sherry is on the line with us from Virginia Beach.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hey, great show, as usual. Yay for public radio for discussing something that is supposed to be taboo. And I just wanted to say that my husband was a revivalist tent preacher in the late 70s, and I was in evangelical churches for about 12 years and studied the Bible a lot. But I've come to the conclusion that, first of all, God is unconditionally loving, and that strictly means there are no conditions, and therefore there can be no punishment or hell. And I think that that we are creative beings always, on this side of and on the other side, and so that when we die or leave our body, we continue creating, so that we may wish to come back to this planet and create something, or we may wish to create and go on creating in another fashion, and that our possibilities are limitless. And I think that sometimes if people have a high expectation of hell, that is the experience they will create when they leave the body. However, they will quickly realize that they can create something better. And I also want to say one more thing, that I think that the problem in on our planet is the idea that one religion is better or has all the answers. I think that's created most of the wars and certainly is now. And that if we gave up the idea of better than and just basically said ours is another way and yours is another way, major changes could happen.
Let me just follow up. Your father was a tent preacher.
No, my husband.
Your husband, excuse me. Does he talk about hellfire and brimstone?
Well, you know, we were in evangelical churches, but he and I always had a hard time accepting the hell concept. And so when he preached, he avoided that, although he was heavy in the Old Testament. And incidentally, he's in heaven now. But he was heavily in the Old Testament and the judgments and the shoulds and should nots and woe unto you and all of those kinds of scriptures. But I think that was just a really old book. It was a long time ago. It was certainly inspired in many aspects, but not to be taken literally and word for word. And I have been reading, because you did ask, you know, where are you getting some of your ideas of heaven from, and I've been reading a lot of books by a man named Neil Donald Walsh.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just follow up with Alan Siegel. Sherry, you write, is not alone in her changing her idea of hell or lack of an idea of hell.
Well, Sherry is very lucky because she's been in both sides of the American coin, both sides of the big rift between the liberal and mainline churches and the evangelical ones. And I think that what she has told us today is very characteristic of the main body of Americans who say that our First Amendment gives us the right to pick and choose what religious futures we want for ourselves. And that, I think, is characteristic of the main part of America. The evangelical part and people who feel most at home within a religious tradition, of course, know that tradition and know what it promises and doesn't promise. And one of the characteristics of evangelical Christianity is that it promises rewards for those who stay true. It's obviously very hard to be an evangelical Christian. You have to give up a lot of temptations. Also, it promises that those people who don't leave such difficult lights as they do will wind up in hell.
Is she also in the mainstream of American thought in her ideas that maybe if religions gave up the ideas of we're number one, things might be better?
Well, I think a lot of Americans are coming to that conclusion. We live in a very multicultural society, and one thing that has to go in a multicultural society is the notion of hell, because you can't wish your neighbors to be damned if you respect them in this life. So I think it makes some sense that Americans don't believe in hell, because we believe that we are all Americans and we are of the right to our beliefs. On top of which, I think that in recent years, if the Gallup poll is right, Americans have been saying more and more that there will be humor in heaven and jokes and good times and self-development. And all of those, I think, are characteristic of a culturally plural society. After all, Americans use jokes about ethnicity to diffuse these tensions that we feel between different religions and different ethnic groups. And so, therefore, humor, I think, has its part in heaven, too.
Just an image of Bob Hope. I'll be here all the eternity.
Yes.
Sherry, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Michael. Michael's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Another caller from Virginia Beach.
Yeah, it's that kind of a place, which is why I came here. I had an experience that coincides with a near-death experience. When my wife was killed and I was in search of some way of contacting God and finding out why such things would happen, where that kind of pain will take you to, and along with experimenting with all of the different religions and looking after gurus and being baptized by Baptists and doing yoga with yogis, I was doing a large amount of hallucinogens one night, and I was on top of a multi-story parking lot in Pennsylvania with a friend of mine, and was having this identity crisis and thinking that I was going insane when I looked at him and I realized he was a very loving person. And when I looked in his eyes, I saw this compassion, and my first thought was, oh, my God, you're Jesus. And he laughed and he said, wow, man, you're going all the way, which made me go inside. And I turned away and I looked toward the sun coming over the mountain. And as that happened, a light came from within me, and I saw this diamond-like light surrounded by pastel-colored clouds with gold sparkles everywhere coming at me. It was a living thing and absorbed me into itself, and I kind of exploded. What the old Rosicrucian ads in the books used to call the split second of eternity and cosmic consciousness, and I literally became one with everything around me in all times. And after a split second, this veil kind of came between us, and I saw it go away, and I wanted to know what it was. And before I could even form the thought, this voice came very loud and very clearly and said, "The word." While that was happening, I experienced the sound of countless millions of voices hitting every note in any scale, higher than the ear could hear and enough to make my body vibrate, singing the syllable, "Ah."
Alan Siegel
was gone.
Yeah. Alan Siegel, Michael, certainly a lot of people have gone on spiritual quests, whether they involve large amounts of hallucinogens or not, I think varies by individual.
Well, that's probably right. And Michael, I think, is one of the lucky people among us for having had an experience of surety. This is a real gift, I think. Not everyone has it on psychotropic drugs, and I'm not recommending that. But near-death experience prophets are people who have been given a special gift, and I think our society appreciates the surety that they have. The rest of us don't have that surety, and I think it makes a difference to know that some people achieve it.
Michael, thank you.
By the way, I'm a minister now, and I teach meditation.
Very good. In which tradition?
In all traditions. One of the things that I learned from it was, going back to the reincarnation thing, as an eternal soul, I believe we come into this planet in different religions so that we can get the gift of each one. I learned to care for my body as a temple from yogis. I learned to meditate from Buddhists. I learned mystical aspects from the Kabbalah. I learned to sing and dance with God's love and joy from Sufis. And every single one of them had a very important lesson for me as a human being, as a whole human being.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you. I think Michael's experience is a good example of the cultural pluralism that's developing in the United States.
Well, here are some of today's headlines from NPR News. The truce between American forces and the militia of militant cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq appears to be breaking down. 15 people have been killed in heavy fighting there, including a U.S. soldier. In Albany, New York, an imam and one of the founders of his mosque have been arrested in an FBI sting operation. They're accused of agreeing to help launder money from the sale of a shoulder-fired missile to be used in shooting down civilian aircraft. You can hear details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. We're talking with Alan Siegel about his book Life After Death. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. John is with us from Buffalo, New York.
Hi. I've been enjoying the dickens out of this, and I've been listening for a long time, waiting to get on.
You've been very patient, John. We appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I hit the big 65 this year, and one's eventual end has interested me a great deal. And it's sort of funny. I know it always interested my brother, and at the age of 70... Two, he suddenly stopped believing anything, which is sort of the position I got into when I was about 12 or 14. I didn't believe anything, and I guess I don't believe anything now. You know, it would be so wonderful if you could live forever. It could be so wonderful if you could do a Groundhog Day. It would be so wonderful if you could do a Philip Jose Farmer, River World. But, you know, at the rock bottom, I can't believe it, and I wonder, Dr. Siegel, what do you believe in your heart of hearts?
Oh, that's a hard question indeed. Well, I don't believe that afterlife is confirmable or disconfirmable. I think that it has something to do with our basic orientation towards life and our way of envisioning who we are. As a matter of fact, I think that throughout Western culture, the afterlife has been a kind of mirror in which we look at ourselves and find out what's important about ourselves. And what we think is most true and enduring and indeed transcendent about our life on Earth. So I think of these notions of the afterlife, which are produced by societies and only recently by individuals, after all, as kinds of mirrors in which a society takes stock of itself and asks itself, what is the most important thing about ourselves? And so I think that that is a very important thing to realize. As to whether any one or another of a particular portraits of the afterlife is true, that depends upon the time that I'm looking at it. But one of the things that has most impressed me about, say, Shakespeare, is that the great poets and playwrights of our culture have always produced very important things about the afterlife by writing fiction. So in my cynical moments, I say that all the historical reports that I looked at are tendentious, and they tell us one thing or another, and they all have to be believed with a grain of salt. But the strange thing about fiction is that you can believe it entirely. In fact, you have to believe Hamlet entirely in order to understand what the play is about. So my feeling is that history always tells lies, but since this is fiction, we can safely believe it.
They talk about a suspension of belief when you go into the theater or open that
right,
novel.
Right, or suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
So
yeah.
That we have to understand that when Hamlet sees the ghost of his father in his mother's bedroom with him, he really sees that ghost, and his mother doesn't, and that's why she says that he's going insane. Or at the beginning of the play when Hamlet says, "Methinks I see my father," and clarifies he means that in his mind's eye, but the people around him, ironically, have just seen his father walk the earth and are reporting to him that they've seen the ghost of his father.
We could do better than ending up where we began this program, and that's Hamlet and his talk about the undiscovered country. John, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Alan Siegel, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Neil. It's been a pleasure.
Alan Siegel's book is Life After Death, A History of Afterlife in Western Religion. We'll leave you with this last email from Patty in Hillsboro, Oregon, who said something like, "If dogs aren't allowed in heaven, then I want to go where they go. Heaven," she writes, "is having my loved ones around me with unending peace and relaxation. Forget the adult education model. I want to snooze in a hammock under a tree." Iris here tomorrow with Science Friday. We'll see you Monday. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News. Thank you.